Welcome to After Hours at the Radio Book Club. It's a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran, News Director at KGNU. Arsene Kashkashian, who is the head buyer at the Boulder Bookstore and really the curator of the book club, as always, my co-host. And this month we have been reading The Past Is Never, an award-winning novel by Tiffany Quay Tyson. Delighted to have her in the studio. A Southern Gothic novel. Now, we kind of got into what exactly that means in the broadcast edition, so do tune in for that. But the place, the sense of place, and there's a couple of different locations that really struck me in the book that would make this such a wonderful film, because it was so cinematic, certainly how you described it. Of course, the quarry, and we talked about how places get this reputation of being haunted because of, you know, tragedies that, you know, happen at a particular location. So there's the quarry, and that's where Pansy disappears to. But later on in the book, it shifts to Florida and in and around the Everglades. And you write beautifully about this. So this is obviously somewhere you've spent time. I know you're from Mississippi, but what about Florida?
Yeah, well, actually, when I was writing the book and I got to a point where it was clear to me that I needed for Bert and Willett to kind of go chasing after their father and their missing sister. And I was trying to think of places that would be good for someone to disappear, which is a thing that, you know, people can still do. It's harder now with all the social media and stuff. But back then, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, it was possible to actually sort of fall off the map a little bit. And Florida is definitely a place where people do that. And I read a lot about the Everglades at that time. I was reading specifically like about, 1980, 1981, that kind of area. And I kept reading these stories, first of all, about like island hermits. So people who lived on these islands, these, you know, in the 10,000 islands, and hardly ever surfaced into the mainland, but occasionally would come in for supplies, but mostly just existed. And then also, I was reading a lot about the smugglers who came in and out of the Everglades and in and out of Florida. And so people have smuggled all sorts of things, but in the 80s, they were really smuggling marijuana, and there were documentaries made about it and tons of articles. And I read a ton of them. I watched the documentaries, and it was just fascinating to me. And so, and I had been to Florida many times, but not, I had actually not spent a ton of time in the Everglades. And I said to my husband, I was like, I think we might need to go take a trip. And we did. And so we spent several days, a better part of a week, I guess, in Everglades City and Chokoloskee Island, which was the place that I had really been researching. And we went kayaking and we went on a boat tour. And I met a guy who actually had spent a good portion of his life in jail for smuggling marijuana. And we sat and we talked late into the night, and I asked him a ton of questions. And it was just fascinating. It's fascinating to me that people can bring in illicit substances and take out illicit substances, and all under the guise of going fishing. I mean, I just thought that that was a fascinating thing. And once I read about it, I knew I would have to use it. And so when we went and we, like I said, we took out the kayaks, and our guide for the kayak said, oh, put that paddle down and use your monkey arms, which makes it into the book. Because I thought that was such a great, just a great piece of advice. And it was really, it was a really fun trip. And, but it was also like, paddling through the Everglades is spooky. I mean, there was an alligator right to my left at one point. And, you know, so I tried to take that experience and put it on the page as richly as I possibly could.
Well, now there's supposed to be all those snakes there too, right?
I know.
Did you see any big snakes?
You know,
I that would terrify me.
Yeah, we didn't see any snakes on that trip. But like all those, you know, I think Florida is just full of snakes. And some of them, many of them, are not even indigenous.
Right.
They're the ones that people just buy those pythons and then flush
and
them.
And they grow huge.
Yeah, they're enormous.
Like
15 yeah, we did
feet
not
long.
See
I mean,
thank goodness.
I bought some photo books which have pictures of Florida snakes. You know, these
yeah.
And I'm just terrified. That's,
they're awful.
And that's why I buy them. I fear if it scares me to death, somebody will want it.
Right.
I don't even. I can't even shelve it. Yeah. I have to close my eyes when I put it on the shelf.
Well, it was funny because one of the animals that ultimately attacks Bert is your commoner gardener raccoon.
Yes.
Which I was like, we have them here. I thought it would be a jaguar or a crocodile or an alligator
yeah.
or different things like that. But it was a raccoon.
I have a So that was a little like, that's my little inside joke for myself. I have a thing about raccoons. I don't like them. And I'm constantly running into them somehow. And it's weird because they are so common. I mean, we had plenty of raccoons in Mississippi. You know, they would get in your trash and stuff. And also, I lived in Texas for a while. Plenty of raccoons everywhere. But for some reason, I find myself constantly like barreling toward them in terrifying moments. And like once I was out, I went out for a bike ride in the kind of at dawn here in Colorado. And I came, it was out on one of the, like, I don't know if it was Little Dry Creek Trail, but one of the little trails around here. And I came around the corner and it's just a little bridge over a creek and there's not much room. And there are two raccoons getting busy in the middle of this trail. And I couldn't stop. Like there was no way for me to stop. I had to actually get past them. And I was terrified that they were going to reach out and they were barking at me and yelling at me. And it was awful. And then not too far away from that time, a little bit later, I went out for a run in the morning and this raccoon comes dashing out from the alley, like with his little paws full of whatever he's pulled out of the dumpster in the alley in our very Denver centric neighborhood. And like screeches to a stop in front of me with his arms held high and, you know, barks. I mean, they don't like me and I don't like them. And so I put that in for, and there are plenty of raccoons actually, you know, in Florida, of course. I put that in just as my own little inside joke for myself. Maybe I'll put a raccoon in every book from now on.
There you go. A rabid raccoon. Because it nearly kills her.
Yeah, it is. It's a rabid raccoon. Yeah. And we get reports of rabid raccoons in our neighborhood. It's insane.
I always feel like any animal that runs around with a mask has got to be up to no good.
Right. Yeah. Right? They're not good animals.
Yeah. Why else would you have a mask?
Right. They're hiding something.
I like when we get the signs in our neighborhood that the squirrels have the plague. You ever see that? The bubonic plague.
Yeah.
And my dad was visiting from Philadelphia one time. We're walking down the street, and on the telephone pole is, you know, squirrels have the plague.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're from Philadelphia. You think the plague is from 1400 or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, what is going on out here? Where have you moved to?
There you go. In your next book, a plague-ridden
squirrel.
A plague-ridden squirrel.
I like it. I
Who needs alligators and crocodiles? We got plague-ridden squirrels.
Yeah.
You know, the quarry is the other great setting, right? We talked about the Everglades, and the quarry is this amazing setting. And there was an incident in the book that I wanted to ask you about is during the Civil War, the slaves in the area have an escape plan, basically, and where they poison the food and kill many people. Where did that come from? Is that based on any real thing? Or
Actually, I did read a lot of historical accounts and scholarly articles and, you know, so a lot of different types of things talking about slaves who either freed themselves or were freed, you know. And so one story that I read did suspect that white slave owners had been poisoned, and they did suspect some of the slaves. It was never proven. It was actually the story that some of the slave owners used as an excuse to go after and try to recapture these freed slaves who were legally freed at this point, of course. And the fact that they had tried to poison this family was one of the reasons they thought they ought to be able to re-enslave them and continue to use them as slaves. I don't think it was ever proven. I don't know that it was real, but I was intrigued by the idea of it.
Yeah, I thought you did a great job with that piece of history kind of in the book. You really fleshed it out with the characters, and it's a children's garden, you know, that they're growing. And as soon as I read what the children were growing, I was like, that doesn't sound good.
All these poisonous plants.
Yeah.
Well, in and around that time, another part of that history that you bring in that time frame is this preacher, this slave who goes and he can read the Bible. And so he is allowed to go and preach to other slaves, particularly the ones building the quarry, because the slave owners think, oh, well, you know, we'll bring this godly person and it'll maybe keep them quiet. But really what he's doing is sending messages as part of the Bible verses. And that's how he's conveying news to the slaves. Mm-hmm. Was that something that you found in the history books as well?
No, that was just my imagination, I suppose. I just really like the idea of I like the idea of sort of passing messages in code and having that sort of, I don't know, that sort of way of communicating amongst some people that other people won't understand. I really liked the idea of that. And when I was writing those pieces from the historical perspective, from the past, a lot of them really came to me. I mean, I don't like to sound too woo-woo about it because, I mean, obviously, I'm just not a real woo-woo person. But I will say that a lot of those did sort of come to me, and I don't know why, and I don't know where they came from. But when I started writing them, I was compelled to finish writing them. And that story in particular, which I think is my mother's favorite piece, that one in particular really came to me with a vengeance. And once I started writing it, I was just compelled to give. I was compelled to give the preacher's name is actually Moses. I was compelled to give him more and more power, I think. And so I did. And I'm very grateful that it made it into the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've spoken before, Tiffany, when you came to KGNU a few months ago about writing authentically in a Southern voice. And of course, you are from Mississippi, so you can do that. But as a writer from that region, you know, what responsibility do you feel then about authentically representing that region, but then also really acknowledging the history, particularly when it comes to not just slavery, but then, of course, the civil rights as well and what happened? I mean, how much does that bear in the back of your mind? It's like, I really have a responsibility to do this right.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like my responsibility as a writer is to not lean heavily on stereotypes, but also not to reject things that happen out of hand in order to protect the communities or the South. I mean, there are terrible things. You know, the South has a really terrible, fraught history, particularly when it comes to race, but also when it comes to women in many cases. And I'm not, you know, I can't not talk about that. I'm not going to pretend like that doesn't exist. I'm not going to pretend like it's the only thing that exists either. So I feel like that's where the balance comes from. And the other thing about, like, I think my stories that are maybe a little different than some Southern stories. So a lot of Southern fiction is written either about sort of the gentried, you know, the gentrified South, or the people who have a good deal of money and perhaps in another era would have been slave owners or would have employed, you know, like black housekeepers and that sort of black nannies and employed black people in ways that is pretty subservient. The people in my books are not wealthy enough to do that and never have been. And yet they're not dirt poor either. They're not, you know, subsisting by digging, you know, carrots out of the dirt and that's all they have. I mean, they actually, you know, these are working people. These are hardworking people. Whether they're working at legal enterprises or not is to be determined. But I think showing those sorts of people in literature is important, as opposed to always focusing on the extremes. You know, the incredibly poor are the wealthier. I mean, those are interesting stories, but they're not all that exist. And so for me, like, I think it's important to both represent, when I'm talking about the South, I want to be sure that I don't sugarcoat anything, but I also don't want to lean too hard on the stereotypes. I also want to make sure that I'm portraying the people in my stories with as much sort of three-dimensional, fully drawn capacity, all the capacity that I have to do that. I don't want anybody to be a caricature. And I think if you avoid the caricatures, you're almost always okay.
Do you see yourself as you're a Southern writer, mm-hmm. but you see, now that you're in Colorado or however long you're here for, or going to be here, do you think you'll always write about the South? I mean, you won a major award for Southern literature for this book, but you're removed from that area now. Will you continue to write about the South, or what you're living now change you as a writer and what you write about?
That's a good question. I don't think that I ever really set out specifically to write about the South. I mean, ultimately, it is the thing that I write about that ends up, you know, that is most compelling to me, and I think more compelling to my readers, probably because I lived the first 21 years of my life in the South, or in Mississippi. And those are really formative years. And so I think when I sit down to write, I'm automatically back in the South. And it is, there's so much. I mean, I could write about the South forever and never run out of material to write about. I do know that for certain. But I love living in Denver. I love living in Colorado. I've been here for 20 years. I really have no intention of leaving at all. And I actually think that living, I go to the South, you know, relatively regularly, a few times a year, I guess. I still have lots of friends there. I still have some family there. But I think that living away from the South and writing about it gives me a better perspective than if I were fully immersed in it all the time. I think that I would not have the perspective and maybe the clarity that I feel like I can bring to it if I had never left. I think leaving is what allows me to write about it. And yeah, someday I may write my way out of it. I mean, maybe I'll, you know, use it all up and find myself. I lived in Austin, Texas for a while. Maybe I'll set something in Austin. Maybe I'll set something in Denver. But for now, it's when I write, it's the place that like calls to me the most.
And do you find people's attitudes here in the West, in Colorado, that people are projecting a certain image that they have of what the South is or should be, what they think, especially misconceptions and stereotypes, and maybe what you should be in their mind as a writer from the South?
Yes. And not just here, but in other places, too. I think that people have a very clear view of what they think the South is, particularly right now, because I feel like every time Southerners are portrayed in the media, you know, whether it's the print media or televised media or social media, it's not good. You know, we see these people sitting on the back of a truck with a deer carcass and they're all, you know, chewing tobacco and holding guns and, you know, spouting their political beliefs. And look, no doubt those people exist. Somebody found them and they interviewed them. I'm not saying that that's not a part of the South, but there are other, you know, other things about, I mean, I am a product of the South as well, just as much as those people are. And so, yeah, I do think that when you first meet people, and I don't have a huge accent. I don't think I have a very strong Southern accent. I have a little Southern accent, and I've lived away from the South. I've lived away from Mississippi for almost 30 years now. So a lot of that has been erased. But when I first moved away, I was in Austin, Texas, which is not the South. Like Texas, parts of Texas may be the South. Dallas may be the South. But Austin is not the South. And I would meet people. And at the time, I was, you know, I was in my early 20s. And I looked very, very young, like very young. And I would meet people. And I had a slightly thicker accent at the time. And I think immediately a lot of people I met, a certain sort of person would think, she must not be very bright. Do you know what I mean? Like, I could see it. I could see them thinking that sometimes. Like, they really underestimate you, which can actually be a benefit. I mean, being underestimated is not always a bad thing, because once you prove them wrong, you've always got the upper hand. But I definitely felt that a lot when I first moved away. Now, I occasionally think people still expect me to be a certain way or ask me questions that seem a little, I don't know, a little weird, like weird things to ask me about the way I've grown up. For the most part, though, I'm a part of a really big, vibrant writing community. And, you know, I think it happens less and less. But yes, I do think there's some really strong misconceptions or preconceptions about what all of the South is like. And I do try to shatter those as much as possible. And I do it largely by recommending, like, people should read Southern authors. Not just Southerners should read Southern authors. Everybody should read Southern authors in the same way that we all read authors from Brooklyn. I don't know why Brooklyn's so special that we all have to read Brooklyn and nobody has to read the South, you know?
Well, this was a finalist in the Colorado Book Awards, and it is a Southern novel. And do you think then this has maybe opened up people's reading capacity? And we've talked a lot about this in the past in other book club editions and in other news shows about the need to read outside your own experience, you know, and how we can really develop empathy and just a greater awareness of the world by reading beyond our own lived experience. Yeah. Now, this has really gotten front and centre in front of so many Colorado readers who may otherwise not read a novel from the South. I mean, what are you hearing?
Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, in terms of Colorado, I don't know, but I mean, I don't know anything specifically. I hope that it has gotten in front of a lot of Colorado readers who are reading a little more widely outside of the South. I mean, I do think that, you know, there's still a huge swath of people all over who think that all Southern writing just sort of begins and ends with Faulkner, and that's all you need to worry about. And if you read nothing else, you're fine. And I think that's short-sighted. So I hope so. I hope that it brings it to a wider audience. I'm also like, it won the Janet Heidinger Kafka Award, which is an award that's given by the University of Rochester in New York. And so that I hope will, I mean, that seems an even wider possible way to spread the word about it amongst people who are not Southerners, who are not traditionally reading Southern novels. I hope so. And I hope not just for my book. I mean, I hope for Southern, you know, contemporary Southern authors, I hope are being more widely read all over. We need to pay attention. And just in the same way that we need to read Western writers. You know, I don't think Western writers are necessarily widely read in the Northeast. And I think that that's something that needs to be done as well. So I would hope we would all read outside of our regional comfort zone.
Could you give us a few contemporary Southern authors that you would particularly recommend or that you enjoy reading?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and you know, Jesmyn Ward, I think, who is from Mississippi and who has now, I think, won the National Book Award twice.
Yeah, she's amazing.
I also am a really big fan of Michael Ferris Smith, who wrote Rivers and The Fighter most recently. I think he's great. I really love, let's see, I'm trying to think of some other ones. Oh, Kent Wascom, who is a New Orleans-based or Louisiana-based writer. He has some wonderful, wonderful books out there. I'm trying to think of a few others. I usually have a list at the top of my head. And in terms of like slightly less contemporary, but also I think really good writers, I love Ellen Douglas. I love Elizabeth Spencer. I loved Ellen Gilchrist. I mean, there's really a wide range of writers.
One of my favorite writers who's probably died 10 years ago or so now is Reynolds Price.
Oh, yeah.
Out of North Carolina.
Yeah.
And he wrote all about the South.
Yeah.
And he wrote beautifully.
Yeah.
And for, you know, classic literature, of course, you got Faulkner, but you have Zora Neale Hurston.
Yeah.
Flannery O'Connor.
I adore Flannery O'Connor.
It really adds to the tapestry of what is American literature. I think it's essential, really, to understanding American literature, to really understand what's going on in the South.
Well, also Donna Tartt, of course, is from the South. You know, Pulitzer Prize winner, big movie being made about her, was just made about, released about her work, or based on her work. So, I mean, that's another good example too, I think, of somebody who writes Southern fiction, but is really worth reading no matter where you're from.
Well, in terms of, you said living away from the South, that, you know, it's interesting. We talk about it as if it's a monolith. I mean, it's the characters in the book, they're in Mississippi, but then it's a big deal for them to go to Florida. They're like, I haven't been to Florida before. You know, we often think of, and we describe regions as monoliths, as if everybody's the same. So I thought that was interesting. But just, you spoke about having the distance to be able to write with a certain perspective. There's also the distance of time, because there are two time periods in this, but the more contemporary one is the 1970s. Mm-hmm. So what was that like to write from a 40 plus year gap and having to dip into that?
Yeah, you know, it's really not, I mean, I didn't find that so difficult because I probably because I was a child at that time. And so I could in some ways draw on my own memories. But one thing, you know, one of the reasons that I set it at that point was that I didn't want to be dealing with cell phones and social media. I knew that somebody had to disappear. I knew that they needed to, you know, I knew that we needed sort of the mystery of the search. And it changes everything to have the technology that we have today. I also, you know, didn't want to have just this wide availability of DNA testing, both for the both for actually law enforcement, but also just for the average person now we have. And so I needed to set things a little bit pre all of that. And that's part of the reason that I did that. But like I said, I mean, I was born in 1969. So, you know, a childhood in the 1970s, 1980s is not outside of my own personal experience. So I didn't have to think too much about that.
Is it possible to have a Gothic novel with a cell phone in it? I mean, is that the end of the Gothic novel?
I hope not. But I mean, it definitely changes things, doesn't it?
Yeah, the
idea of a cell phone in a Gothic novel, a crumbling cell phone,
yes.
Maybe.
Well, we've spoken to so many authors who have set their books just in this time before social media, not even like the cell phone, but really social media, because that has fundamentally changed everything.
Yeah.
How people communicate, how young people communicate. But yeah, if you want to go get yourself lost in the Everglades in Florida,
right,
if you've got a cell phone with the GPS, boom, that's that right. plan gone.
Well, it's almost impossible.
Well, these kids wouldn't have been at the quarry. They would have been, it was a hot day, they would have been inside playing video games or something, right? I mean,
yeah, you know, it changes everything.
Yeah, it's interesting. I also thought it was interesting. Parenting has changed since the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps you wouldn't have these kids out on their own in the same way because of all the different things that have happened. And because not that much has happened, but because of what's happened as far as things being spread. Every missing person is spread nationwide. Every kidnapping is spread nationwide. And we're more terrified than ever to let our kids walk down the street, even though crime isn't any worse than it was. It's probably better than it was in the 70s. So I thought that was an interesting, the whole premise of the book might be different now.
Oh, I think it would be. And actually, it is interesting because there is a portion in this book where she talks about how the world after this child goes missing, the world of their neighborhood basically,
right, the whole town
changes. For everybody, because all of a sudden kids are not allowed to just go roam or do whatever, which I do think is, you know, it is interesting to go from that sense of like total freedom as a child to suddenly being locked, you know, kind of locked down. And I don't think kids today have as much ability to roam free. I mean, I was actually talking to my mother recently and we were talking about how when I was a kid, like we would in fact go out in the morning and go walk to our friend's house or bike to our friend's house or bike to the swimming pool or whatever it is that we wanted to do without a whole lot of, I mean, we didn't think about it that much. We just did it. And we had a creek that ran alongside behind our neighborhood, Caney Creek, that we would go down and, you know, play superhero stories in and stuff. I don't think that was strictly allowed, but there was no way to stop us. And so you don't have so much of that nowadays.
Well, now there are whole theories emerging about all these different styles, parenting, helicopter parenting, or free range parenting, and the need to have all of that. But I thought it was interesting. Yeah, you talk about how the neighborhood changed because it changed suddenly. It wasn't this thing that we've seen kind of evolve over the last 40 years. For this neighborhood, it was like the day after Pansy goes missing.
Right,
the kids
suddenly
don't get to go out anymore.
Yep, absolutely.
So what's next for you after you finish a book like this?
Well, for the past year, I've been going around and doing readings and interviews and things like that. And I also do teach at Lighthouse Writers Workshop. And so, you know, I've been kind of focused on all of that. I have started writing another novel. It is also still set in the South, so I haven't written my way out of the South yet. But it is a long way from being done. And so I'm going to hopefully within the next month or so sit down at my computer a lot every single day and write that book so that I can hopefully have a third novel out in the world, which would make me very happy.
And is that hard to do when you're still, you know, talking about these characters all the time and obviously still living through them, then to try to sit down and come up with a whole new set?
It is a little bit. I mean, I think that, so I had a book before The Past Is Never called Three Rivers In. I had already started writing The Past Is Never before Three Rivers even, before it was published, and really a little bit before it was sold even. I think I had written at least a scene. And so I was a little further into it and a little more invested in it, I think, and it was a little bit easier for me to keep going. I mean, there was a period of time where I had to kind of look away and deal with the book that was being published, but I was able to get back into it. It is a little bit harder right now, I think, because I do feel like I am suddenly talking about these characters again in a way that I didn't necessarily expect to do. And it's like a different world. I'm in a different world than the one I'm trying to write. But I have faith that I'll be able to get it done.
Is there a rabid raccoon in the new book?
Not yet, but there could be.
Well, Tiffany Quay Tyson has been our guest after hours at the Radio Book Club, a podcast only edition of the Radio Book Club. So please do subscribe if you're not already a subscriber. Leave a review as well. Well, a good review. Don't bother. Say something nice. But make sure you can catch the broadcast edition on the fourth Thursday of every month at 9 a.m. on KGNU. As always, Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore is my co-host. Thank you.
Thank you.
And for KGNU, I'm Maeve Conran.